Look up idiot in the dictionary, you know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I'm your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am embarrassingly ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important. Thus, I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring some classic Christmas films, as recommended by Alonzo Duralde of the Linoleum Knife podcast. And this week's episode, I'll be talking about the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol, otherwise sometimes known as Scrooge. So those of you out there who are looking for information for it or are trying to find it on streaming services, maybe try shifting away from the search for A Christmas Carol and try searching for Scrooge, because if you actually watch the opening credits, you'll see it is in big letters said or titled Scrooge, and then in little letters kind of A Christmas Carol, as adapted by from Charles Dickens' novel, I should say. I'll be honest in this one that I was a little bit nervous or trepidatious, I suppose, about recording this episode, because really, A Christmas Carol has been adapted so many times, countless times, as dramas, as comedies, as live action, as TV, as animated, as feature films, that I was really sort of worried because I wasn't really sure what I could say about it, and really thinking that anything that I could say about it has probably already been said literally dozens of times, if not hundreds of times, by thousands, if not millions of people, because really, iterations of the story have been around for so long that I'm probably not adding anything new to the conversation. However, this is my podcast. I have an obligation to you, the listener, and I also have an obligation to Alonzo, who was nice enough to give up his time. And I suppose, watching it for the first time, I do have some specific thoughts, or at least why it resonated with me. So, having said all that, I guess it's a moot point. So why don't we just continue on with the episode? But allegedly, this version, the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol, is sort of considered by many folks throughout history and I guess around the world as sort of the definitive or the go-to version of A Christmas Carol. I didn't know that until after I was done watching it, but reading that, it sort of made sense, and I'll certainly get into why, why that is in a little bit, but one thing that occurred to me as I was watching this movie, and also just thinking back on all sorts of adaptations of A Christmas Carol, and granted, I'll admit that I haven't seen many. There's this one, there's Scrooge, the 1988, I believe, comedy with Bill Murray, A Muppet Christmas Carol, which to this day is still my favorite one, I won't say best, though, also the George C. Scott one from, I think, the 1970s or 1980s, which I admittedly don't remember too much. But I was thinking that there's really so many adaptations of this story that we kind of lose track or kind of lose perspective, and really how difficult of a story this actually can be to tell on film. And I think it might be because of, or maybe in spite of, the fact that we've seen so many adaptations that we kind of lose focus on how challenging it is to adapt this novel to a three-act structure or something which has such a rigid structure as a TV movie or as a feature film. Because really, if you think about it, a lot of adaptations that you're seeing, there's a certain creative twist on it. For instance, The Muppet Christmas Carol obviously has the Muppet charm with not just puppets, but also musical interludes. You have the Scrooged version, which is a modern day, update, or at least modern contemporary update as it was in the 1980s. So adjusting the time frame, the geographic setting, and the occupations of all the people involved. But then after that, you kind of wonder, like, why are there these different versions? Is it just one company, trying to cash in on this story because the rights are certainly in the public domain? Anyone can kind of really make an adaptation of it, if you will. And you'd like to think that everyone has a different reason or a different creative drive for adapting this story, but really, I think if we're honest with ourselves, a lot of times, what stands out to us, not even what stands out to us, but what stands for a good or acceptable adaptation is sort of just how faithful the film is in checking off the bullet points of the finer points of the story. Obviously, you're going to have, Ebenezer Scrooge, who is a kind of an asshole of a miser. You're going to have Bob Cratchit, or some iteration of Bob Cratchit, who is the put-upon assistant. You're going to have the dead former business partner who comes back and tells him about these three spirits. You're going to have the three spirits. You're going to have the exploration of the past, the present, and the future. And then you're going to have redemption at the end. You know, every film goes through that to one extent or another. And really, I feel like we kind of are only looking for those bullet points to be checked off. We're not really looking for anything which is too groundbreaking. We're kind of looking for comfort. We're just looking for validation in a way, if you will. And I think once again that sort of approach to this sort of film covers up or distracts from the fact that this can be a challenging adaptation. There has to be a specific approach. There has to be an appreciation of not just the source material, but how to adapt the source material to a different medium in order for it to be a good adaptation. And the reasons that I say that are pretty twofold. And that's one is the idea that your protagonist of the story is in many ways largely a passive character. He's not really, you know, his emotional arc or the journey that he goes through is not him really acting, or I should say, being proactive in a lot of ways, but it's sort of him reflecting and being reactive to a lot of things that happen. I mean, I'd say what? Let's say it's safe to say about between 60 to 75% of the story, depending on which version you're watching, depending on how long it is really Ebenezer Scrooge sitting back and watching things unfold before him. Certainly, it's made very clear at the very beginning of the story when he's with the Ghost of Christmas Past that these are but the shadows of things that have been. He can't change them. He can't interact with them. He can't do anything about it. He just has to sit there and watch. So you have, on one hand, first and foremost, a story in which our protagonist is largely not going to do anything except for watch events that unfold before him or that have unfolded before him. So that's sort of challenging, because that's a different approach. You know, we're not really used to that in terms of films. You know, typically the protagonist is very proactive, or should be very proactive, in the journey that he or she is going to go through. And then also, in order to be emotionally invested in this story, really depends on how emotionally effective and resonant the past, the present, and the future explorations are going to be. If you don't show enough, if you don't do a well enough job as a director depicting the events of the past, then you don't really fully get that sense of regret and of remorse of things that have been. If you aren't celebratory enough in regards to how you depict the events of the present, you really don't get the sense, or Scrooge won't get the sense, that he's missing out on something, that he has been confused by, you know, his previous assumptions about the Christmas holiday season. And if you don't make the future events, well, it's not even if you don't make the future events bleak enough, but you don't, if you don't have the past and the present, you know, potent enough combination, then the fact that nobody will care about his demise shouldn't really, or doesn't really hit home with him and with us. So I think we get so caught up in this idea of like, okay, you know, in the past, does it show this? Great. In the present, does it show this guy doing that? Great. In the future, does it show these people making fun of Scrooge? Great. Okay, that's all that we need. But really, we need more than that in order for this to be a very good adaptation, because I think we forget we need to be emotionally invested in those events for specific reasons, because they all add up. It's an equation. It's an algorithm that all add up to a certain outcome, and that outcome is of course, supposed to be the redemption of Ebenezer Scrooge. Now, having set that up and having said that, I do fully believe, and I do go along with now the consensus, that this version is the go-to and the best version of A Christmas Carol. I won't say that it's my favorite. My favorite still is A Muppet Christmas Carol for various reasons that I won't get into in this episode. But I do think that this version, the 1951 version with Alastair Sim as Ebenezer Scrooge, is the best version, because it doesn't just go through those checklists and mark off the main event or the events that we are expecting A Christmas Carol to go through. It doesn't just go through the motions. It gives us a reason to be invested in those. There is a certain approach by director Brian Desmond Hurst that adds a weight, adds a gravity, adds a significance to the events that Scrooge has been through. And part of that is the direction. Part of that is has to do with not just the facts or the events that he chooses to include. It's not just going through the checklist, but it's also by adding certain events that aren't in the original source material that sort of add a complexity to the Scrooge character. But it's also, I think, the performance of Alistair Sim as Scrooge, which really kind of makes this the most complex and complicated and nuanced version of A Christmas Carol, in my opinion. And so I think it does immediately start with the performance of Alistair Sim as Ebenezer Scrooge. And once again, I'll say Ebenezer Scrooge, or Michael Caine as Ebenezer Scrooge, is still my favorite depiction, but he chooses both of these actors choose to approach the character in different ways. With Michael Caine in A Muppet Christmas Carol, you really kind of get the sense that he is a guy that is wounded, that is sort of hurt, and is after the events of The Ghost of Christmas Present, it's almost sort of, you know, he finally has permission to rejoice, to be joyous, and you know, sort of like he's healing from the wounds that he has, like, you know, you kind of get the sense that his Ebenezer Scrooge is damaged, and I think we're supposed to get that, but I think it's a different kind of damage. And honestly, my main problem with most depictions of A Christmas Carol that I've seen is that the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, Future, whatever it is you want to call it, almost seems superfluous. You know, it seems like most Scrooges are already convinced by the end of the events of The Ghost of Christmas Present. And the Ghost of Christmas Future, the events that he sees there, is really, and I'm sorry for this analogy, this is terrible and it's extreme, but it's the first thing that comes to my head. It's sort of the nuclear bomb on the Christmas Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, the battle was already won after the events of Christmas Present, and you know, the events depicted in Christmas Yet to Come are just sort of the really hard period on the end of the sentence, and almost they don't even seem entirely necessary. I don't think that's the case with this version. With this version, I actually kind of see an Ebenezer Scrooge who is still very much on the fence until he sees all these things in the events of what are yet to come. And that's what ultimately pushes him over the edge. You know, not to say that that was the only one that was necessary, but it was the 1-2 punch of past and present. And then he's still kind of on the fence and worried and is wary and is not entirely sure. But then it's what he sees what's to come and what he, you know, the terrible things that will come without his change, without his intervention, that's ultimately what changes him. And a lot of that, I think, has to do first with the depiction of Ebenezer Scrooge as Alistair Sim. Not as Alistair Sim, but by Alistair Sim as Ebenezer Scrooge. And I think it's weird that I should say this, but I think it gets back to, at its root, the word or the phrase "bah humbug." And most of us, because of all these iterations of A Christmas Carol, and because we've heard it over and over and over again, it just kind of, to us, it sort of, not loses its meaning, but it essentially has just become a sort of generic phrase for bullshit or kind of like, ah, get away from here or leave me alone. But really, and I'm stealing this directly from the IMDb trivia page for Christmas Carol, so let me just read it. The word humbug describes deceitful efforts to fool people by pretending to be a fake loftiness or false sincerity. So when Scrooge calls Christmas a humbug, he is claiming that people only pretend to charity and kindness in a scoundrel effort to delude him, each other, and themselves. In Scrooge's eyes, he is the one man honest enough to admit that no one really cares about anyone else. So for him, every wish for a Merry Christmas is more deceitful effort to fool him and take advantage of him. Now, that doesn't seem like, you know, so in that context, the bah humbug doesn't seem like just a response from a crotchety old asshole. It actually kind of, it's a guy who has been, who feels like he's the one that has the truth, that he sees everyone else as being deceitful around him, and that he is the one who really is, you know, is clued into what's going on, and he hates everyone else around him for buying into this falseness. Now, where does an attitude like that come from? That comes from a guy who has gone through a lot of hurt and a lot of damage. And the way that Alistair Sim plays the Ebenezer Scrooge character, especially in the first, I'd say, maybe 15, 20 minutes before he starts on his grand voyage into Christmases, past, present, and future, you have a guy who, he doesn't seem so much like a jerk to me. He seems instead sort of like a guy who is, I don't even want to say apathetic, but he couldn't give a shit, you know? He's a guy who, he wants to be left alone, don't bother him, and he's sort of, you know, he's sort of, you kind of get the sense of he's this guy who isn't going to be proactive in how disgusted, you know, he is of you, but he's a guy who's instead going to be very reactive instead. This isn't a guy who's going to seek you out to scold you or to be a curmudgeon to you. He's a guy that if you leave him alone and he leaves you alone, you're going to be okay with each other. You know, this is a guy who I think instead is just very, very solitary, not so much hurt, but a guy who has a view or a warped view of the world because of so many wrongs that have been done to him in the past. And he's developed this lens through which he sees the world that he believes is truthful. It's not so much that he's hurt, that he's got, you know, a soft underbelly like a lot of Scrooges, but he's in a defensive, protective shell because of what's happened to him. And you may say that, well, yes, that's obvious, and yes, that's what I see in every Scrooge that I've seen, and so maybe I haven't explained myself well enough, but I love Alistair Sim, you know, I love the little touches that the director brings to this, because there's a lot of shots of Scrooge by himself. And not just when he's walking to and from work, but there's a very brief scene after Scrooge leaves work where he's eating alone, and he asks the waiter for more bread, and the waiter says it's going to be more charge, and he says, no more bread then. And there's something so sad about that shot of him just sitting there eating alone, not even wanting to pay extra for more bread, and like that's not, I wasn't angry about that, you know, like my reaction to that is sort of pity for that guy. And I don't think that pity is really an emotion that I felt for any other depiction of an Ebenezer Scrooge in any other iteration of the story at that point in the film, at least. And then that just continues throughout as these ghosts come in, and as he goes through this journey, you really like see Sim's character, the way that he carries himself, the way that he slumps his shoulders, the way that his face sags and his eyes sag. You really get the sense of this is a guy who there's a lot of weight on him. He you know, him going through the past and him seeing through the present, he's not only reminded of the things that he has done wrong, of the things that are still weighing on him, of the things that have led to his creation of this worldview, but then he's also confused by what he sees in Christmas present. It's not so much that he is joyful about it, like, oh my God, I'm buying into Christmas now because people are so happy and they're eating figgy pudding and they're dancing. It's not that, but he's sort of confused because he has a worldview and he sees some things which are in direct contradiction to that worldview. And it's I'm sure it's probably exciting, but it's also a strange reaction. He himself doesn't seem to know how to respond to the things that he is seeing. And that's wonderful that there's this confusion, that he doesn't buy into this stuff right away. He himself is conflicted about what he's experiencing. And that conflict, I haven't seen that so much in past iterations of A Christmas Carol. And it's all in how Alistair Sim carries himself, how he physically carries himself as Ebenezer Scrooge. And it's wonderful to me that, you know, even, and like I said, that it doesn't seem like this Scrooge is entirely convinced until he's, you know, he's got the past, present, and the future. Even after he sees the events that are depicted in Christmas present, in the celebration of his nephew and his nephew's wife, and in how the Cratchit family can be so happy, you know, despite the fact that they are so impoverished, even after he sees through all that stuff and he sees his beloved or his former beloved, you know, working so hard to take care of the poor and the impoverished, even after he sees all that, he still hasn't bought into it. He still openly muses, not to himself, but to the ghost of Christmas present. He says, he still expresses doubt that he is worth saving. He says, you know, I'm too old to change at this point. Is it even worth, you know, my redemption? Is it even worth saving me? And I think that's a brilliant little move in the sense of, you know, this isn't a guy who is easily swayed, you know, this isn't a guy who is just waiting to be a pushover. This is a guy who for his entire life has seen the world through one way. This is a guy who has eventually built up such a callous to the world that when his own business partner dies, he just takes it in stride. A guy that he has known for probably decades, a guy that started out as a coworker of his, a guy that, you know, they started out as business partners or became business partners, I should say, and then opened up their own business and ran it for years and years and years. This is a guy who, when he is confronted with his own business partner's death, it's just a matter of fact to him. There's no emotion about it. This is just the way that it is. People are born, they go through life, and they die. And all of a sudden, he is confronted with this idea of love and of joy and of regret and of the ability to change and still live here in the moment. And that conflicts with everything that he has known for decades, man, of his entire life. And I mean, think about that. How hard of a change that's going to be. You know, these movies or these adaptations of A Christmas Carol love to make it so easy and so joyous, because that's what we want to see in a Christmas movie. We want to see redemption. We want to see love overcome. We want to see joy and jubilation and celebration. But when you have a worldview and you've had that worldview so firmly entrenched in you for so long, and then all of a sudden you are confronted with so much evidence about how that is wrong and how things are different than how you see, I mean, it takes time to adapt to that. And I haven't really seen too much of that, or at least I haven't seen a really effective depiction of that until I saw Alistair Sim in this iteration of A Christmas Carol. One of the things that, or I'd say the biggest thing that is helping, I don't necessarily want to say it's helping Alistair Sim, but I think Alistair Sim's performance enhances the fact that, as Alonzo mentioned in the introduction episode of this episode, is that the introduction episode of this month, there we go, is that there were actually scenes added into this adaptation or this iteration of it that were not included in the original story of A Christmas Carol. Were not, to the best of my knowledge, included in other iterations. And some of those scenes are, they really, and this is what I think is important, they really bulk up the Christmas past section. I'd say it's I can't really think of a ratio per se, but certainly in terms of the three spirits that come to haunt him, I'd say we spend the least amount of time in Christmas present, and Christmas yet to come is somewhere in the middle, but we spend the most time in Christmas past, and that's because they've added some things. And once again, it still has the usual things that you think of. It has Scrooge as a schoolboy who is sort of neglected by or has neglected his friends for the purposes of studying. You have him falling in love with a woman and then opting to end the relationship, or positioning business over personal affections instead of pursuing the relationship. But then you also have a few other things. You do have a scene where Marley and Scrooge meet for the first time, and that is after Scrooge is poached from, you know, Fezziwig's business, because he starts out as an apprentice in Fezziwig's business, but then this film adds a scene in which another businessman comes to purchase Fezziwig's trading store or whatever it is that Fezziwig does. Fezziwig turns him down, and so instead, I guess as a response, this man poaches Ebenezer Scrooge from Fezziwig and brings him to work for him instead. That's where him and Marley meet. That's where him and Marley decide to go into business together, and that ultimately takes the form of Fezziwig, of Marley and Scrooge buying Fezziwig's business instead and taking it over. Now, that's a detail. Those are details that were not in the original Christmas Carol or Christmas Carol adaptations that I have seen. But it, especially within the interactions between the man who poaches Scrooge, between Scrooge and Marley, you really kind of get the sense of the bricks being laid down to support or start building on this worldview of self-betterment, of financial gain, of how there are certain things in this world that you can't control, and some of the most valuable things in this life are going to be what you put into it, or I should say what you get out of it. And most immediately, most superficially, that is wealth, and that is business, and that's why you eventually see this turn in the Scrooge character, who, as a young child, did very much love his sister, but turns into this guy eventually who sees more gain from financial benefits, and that has to do with once again another change in which the writers or the director switch the order in which Scrooge and his sister were born. And you have the scene where when Scrooge's sister is dying, a woman whom he loved so much, and he gets so enraged over the fact that he can't control death, or he can't do anything about her death, and he runs out of the room, and she, in her delirium, mutters a last wish and a last sentence to him, which is to take care of her son, who is going to grow up and be Fred. But Scrooge misses that, and I think that's a very vital scene. That's an important scene in which he misses this last declaration of love from someone whom he loved very much. And you can almost kind of see where the roots are being laid down, that he can't do anything about death. He can't do anything really about life. The only thing he can do, the only thing that he really has control over, is how much wealth he can amass for himself. And you can, and I think it's super important that you have that idea of this guy who, at a very young age, missed such an important message from arguably the only person that he really cared about. And what he took away from that whole experience instead was how much love can hurt you. And the only thing that you can control, you can't control what happens to those around you. You can't control what happens to your sister, to your mother, to anyone else. The only thing that he can, that you can really control, is how much wealth you accumulate in this world. So does it really come as any surprise that eventually, when he is forced to make that decision between love of his partner, I believe in this her this iteration, her name is Alice. When he has to choose between that and finances, is it any surprise that a man who has been hurt in such a way, and by a man who has seen so many benefits in one realm and not in the other, is it any surprise that Ebenezer Scrooge chooses wealth over love? I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying that narratively or thematically that is the right choice to make. But the important point is that we can empathize with the Scrooge character, that we understand how he could have gotten to that point. And that's something that I don't think a lot of Christmas Carol adaptations have done well. But this one, I think, does it exceptionally well. And that is, once again, that combination of the scenes that they have included and the way that Alistair Sim has chosen to play the Scrooge character as a result of all those things that he sees. But, you know, on terms of a superficial level, this film also does a lot of things very, you know, very well also. If you are not super into film, if you're not a cinephile, if you're kind of a casual fan, I don't know if I'd necessarily recommend this iteration to you, because in terms of production value, it can be a little bit rough. It is an older film. It's over 60 years old at this point. And there are some rough spots in regards to some of the effects might seem a little bit quaint. Some of the weird fades are a little unusual. The production value certainly seems to be very, you know, kind of low. You don't really get a sense of a grand scale or scope of anything, including in Scrooge's house. You know, it does seem very small scale and very cramped. And also the sound is a bit rough in regards to, you know, the score being very loud at some point and being very uneven, very low at other points. So it's kind of rough going, and if you're just sort of a casual fan, it might be kind of a rough experience for you. You know, you might be kind of one of those sort of like, well, this is stupid, black and white, and all these cuts are weird. You know, we do things so much better technically nowadays. And yes, we do, but there is so much, not only emotion to this one, but there are also some directorial flares that I think also work really well, including, this is the most haunting version of Bob Marley, of Jacob Marley to Ebenezer Scrooge that I have ever seen in my life. And that's a combination of a few things, and that has to do with the way that the film is shot, because up to that point, there is almost kind of a film noir quality to it, especially when Scrooge is walking alone at night. When he gets into his apartment, you have sort of this chiaroscuro lighting in which there are some really harsh shadows and some really bright points of light. Combine that with a score, which is very evocative and very spooky. And then, you know, the sound effects in which you hear Marley's voice, you know, Scrooge. And it is creepy. And then Marley shows up to try and warn Scrooge, you know, as Marley is wont to do. And there's just this... I don't even know how to describe it, but there's a point where he's rattling his chains and he's screaming, and it's so piercing and it's so loud and it's so offsetting and so disturbing in such a way that it really sort of stuck with me. And then after that, and this is if you've read the book, it's been such a long time for me, and I think to the best of my recollection, this little segment I'm about to talk to has not been included in it, where after Marley is wrapping everything up, he walks Scrooge over to a window and points outside to what appears to be a poor woman outside in the cold on her own, trying to hold a child to her and keep it warm. And what Scrooge is able to see from that point is what Marley points out to him, is all these, is just so many transparent figures. All these, I believe what they're supposed to be, are restless spirits, all of whom, like Marley, are trying to have an effect on this world, on this life, and are unable to. This is a weird combination to or comparison to make, but I was sort of at that point almost reminded of the Lost Souls room in Beetlejuice, at least in regards to I don't even know. There's no thematic or narrative comparison what to make, but it's just it's I think the visuals of all these flailing spirits who are just sitting there and having no real effect on the real world, and there's something tragic about them. There's something haunting about that. Just a thought of Marley is sort of not the last of his kind, but that there are so many people or so many spirits out there who are trying to do for other people what Marley is currently doing for Scrooge, and they are failing. And how tragic of a thought that is in regards to how many people are losing out in this world on a chance at redemption because these spirits are ineffectual. But it's also just kind of really creepy in that old-fashioned, you know, film technique sense to see these, you know, somewhat transparent people just flailing around and having no effect on what's going on. It is truly, to me, really super haunting. And I think, you know, to kind of wrap this all up, one of the reasons that I think this film works is not just because of how certain scenes are written, but also how certain scenes are shot and performed. And I mean, outside of Alistair Sim, and I don't know off the top of my head the names of any of the other actors who are in this movie, but it just seems like this version of A Christmas Carol, you know, makes the lows really low and the highs really high, in the sense of Bob Cratchit, when he's around Scrooge, really do get the sense of he's this guy who's very tense, who's very nervous about what his employer is going to say. But then when you see him within the walls of his home, when he is free, when he is amongst those he loves and those who love him, he just seems like the happiest fucking guy in the world. He just seems like he's so thrilled to be here. He's so happy to be with his family on Christmas Day, with this meager feast, with his cripple son. Even if it's the only day off that he gets in the entire year, he's so happy for that year. He's so happy for what he has in front of him, that you get the sense when he raises a glass and says to Ebenezer Scrooge, the founder of the feast, you really get the sense he means it. And that's something that I think is lost in other iterations as well, is once again, it's an obligatory thing to kind of have that line in other movies. But in this one, you really feel like he means it when he says it. And when the lows happen, when Scrooge sees, you know, the people who are profiting off his death in regards to selling the, you know, his shit after he has gone, and after he's talking to, and he sees the people who the fellow businessmen who really don't care about his death at all, those lows and those highs really hit home because the film has done such a good job of setting them up and making them seem significant and important. And so that's why it's wonderful when he finally shows up at the end to have Christmas dinner with his nephew and his nephew's wife. And you really do get the sense that Fred is super happy to have him there, that his wife is very happy to have him there, that he is happy to be there, that he is dancing and laughing and having a good time. And when he says he's as light as a feather and as happy as an angel and as merry as a schoolboy, you really do get the sense that he feels that way, that he is that way, and not just that we have gotten to that point because that's where the story ultimately commands that he get to. It really feels like those things have happened. It really feels like he has gone through that change because the film has done such a good job in its writing, in its depiction, in its setup, and its execution. And I totally get now why people kind of consider this the go-to version for A Christmas Carol, the best version of A Christmas Carol. Even if, like I said, it's not necessarily my favorite version for personal reasons, but I can say that I do think, that I do agree with the consensus, this one to me is the best one. So if you haven't seen it and you're like, oh wow, this is really strong praise, obviously you want to know where to find it. This one, it's not difficult to find, but it is not the easiest one in the world. As far as I can tell, there's really only two ways if you want to take a look at it. If you still have the Netflix disc plan, it's easily available there. The only other way that you can really get your hands on it is through Amazon, specifically the Amazon Instant Video. Super cheap, though. I think it's $2 to rent for 3 days, and it's like $3 if you want to buy it. And it's less than 90 minutes long. It's a pretty quick watch, but I think it is an effective watch. So I would definitely recommend it out there for anyone who hasn't seen it. If you have seen it, maybe you agree with me. Hopefully you agree with me, but if not, I always want to hear what you have to say. Easy enough to reach me, youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. I do movies badly on Facebook. Nolan Fixes Teeth on Twitter. BattleshipRetention.com, go to podcasts and find I Do Movies Badly for back episodes, or, of course, as I said last week, you can go on iTunes and find me, and you can find all my back episodes, beginning with episode 1, Introduction to David Mamet. It is all there. Let me know what you think. I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about if you think this one is the best one, if you think another one is the best one. Let's start a dialogue. Certainly there's no harm in that. Other than that, I got nothing else to say besides thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next week where I will be reviewing Remember the Night and wrapping up classic Christmas films as recommended by Alonzo Duralde, and where hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.